This podcast is sponsored by PAX. Whether on water, on land, or in the air, PAX bags are both versatile and flexible backpacks that are perfectly suitable for your requirements in the most demanding of environments. PAX bags are highly regarded due to their exceptional performance in pre-hospital and in critical care environments. Renowned for their durability, they endure harsh conditions while providing rapid and reliable access to essential kit. So their well-organized compartments and customizable configurations enhance efficiency in high-stress situations. PAX bags are designed with infection control in mind and are easy to clean and disinfect. Their highly visible colors and reflective strips add quick identification and adherence to quality standards, assuring reliability. The versatility of PAX bags caters to a diverse EMS providers, but also delivers vital equipment and durability and ease of use for pre-hospital critical care services globally. I've used PAX bags in a number of critical care situations, and they're absolutely excellent. Please see the show notes for further details.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with me, Carl Betts. In this episode, I'm really looking forward to speaking to Robbie Maiden. Robbie is a lifeboat coxswain for the Royal National Lifeboat Institution in the northeast of England. As a coxswain, he's the leader of a small crew of volunteers who answer the call when received to fulfil the primary role of saving lives at sea. I'm really interested to hear Robbie discuss his leadership attributes, what skills it takes to lead a group of volunteers, and also how his experiences have shaped how he operates and how he makes decisions. It's great to have you on, Robbie, and welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Carl.
In this sort of conversation, I'm really interested to sort of have a chat to you about you as a person and what it takes in your experience to be a successful leader within a lifeboat environment where you're working with volunteers, sometimes in a pretty harsh environment when everybody else is coming into port, you're sometimes heading out. And just get a feeling of your sort of history, really, of how you've got to where you are and what's made you you with your past experiences. So first off, I think it would be sort of prudent to just to get a flavour of your history within the lifeboat service, because it is extensive, and it would be good to sort of paint that picture, really.
Yeah, no problems. Well, to say extensive, yes, very. It feels it. Every bone in my body aches and creaks with all those years. My first introduction to the RNLI was probably 50 years ago when I was a small boy, 7-8 years old, and I would go to the station with my father. He was also Robbie Maiden, and he was the coxswain on the lifeboat back then. So as a young boy, I would go around with my dad of a weekend and after school during the week, and I'd give them give the lads a hand to clean the boat, polish the brass. They'd teach me how to tie knots, splice ropes, what the bits and bobs were on the boat, and how it came on. So this progressed into my early teens when I got to do a little bit more, and maybe when I was 13 or 14, they probably shouldn't have done this, but I'd get a quick run out on the boat and get to, you know, get a taste of what it was all for. When I actually turned 17, my birthday present of my mum and dad was my dad got my mum to sign the forms so I could join the lifeboat crew. So that was then the youngest you could be to join. So I joined on the 4th of August, 1984, I think it was, the day I turned 17. So that was my birthday present. So I then became crew. My father was still coxswain, and how can I say, I understand this now, but he could not show me any favouritism. So I had to do maybe a little bit more than what the other lads had to do just to prove that I had a purpose to be there. And anyhow, I enjoyed that, and it done me no harm at all. And like I say, I really took it on board. When I was in my early 20s, one of the crew approached me dad and says, I think young Robbie's ready to become helmsman on the little lifeboat. Because we had two lifeboats, and Atlantic 21, which back at the time had twin 50 horsepower even rubes on the back of it. And then we had the all-weather lifeboat, the Scout. So I was a crew member on both. Just when I said I joined the lifeboat crew when I was 17, I actually went on my first call out when I was 16, because we had a young guy got washed off the pier at North Gare, and my dad was a bit short of crew. So he says, get your wellies on, son. And we went out and we spent 4 or 5 hours. Unfortunately, we didn't find the young gentleman, but that was my first call out doing a search with my dad. So, yeah, I progressed on. I became a helmsman on the little lifeboat. And then, what would I be? In my late 20s, my father had retired. Eric Reeves had been the coxswain for 6 or 7 years, I think it was. And Eric retired. And that's when I became coxswain. For a short period of time, I was the youngest coxswain that the Iron Lion ever had. I'm not sure whether that's changed anymore, but I remember getting a letter from the Iron Lion basically saying, why is this young boy doing this job? But anyway, it seemed to have gone all right. They haven't got rid of me yet. And I think that was in 1998 when I became coxswain. I'm still here now. So
yeah, it's an amazing story, and that sort of thing, that, you know, that life apprenticeship, that you've had a life apprenticeship from your dad, and from, I know, the lifeboat's like a family in its own right, isn't it? Is the fact that, you know, you're brought up around these people.
You touched on it earlier on that we're dealing with volunteers here, so it's not in a work environment where you're there to do your 30, 40, 50 hours a week. These guys are coming down when they should be at home with the friends or with the families or whoever. So we have to, and the Iron Lion has to remember this. It has to be encompassed into the full thing, because that's the nucleus of it. That's what makes it all work and tick.
Yeah, yeah, especially the volunteer side of it is one of the key aspects of it. It is the volunteer, and that's why people, I know when I was a crewman, being a volunteer was one of the key parts of it. I didn't want any money for it. It was the fact that it was just a really interesting thing to do. So I'm keen to chat about some of the sort of key incidents where your leadership skills have been tested and how you reacted at the time, but also how, like, you might have reflected from that and developed as a leader. Because I understand that you've probably not been on lots of formal military style leadership courses, you know, you've not been on really sort of in-depth leadership qualifications, and your leadership style from me knowing you is sort of very much experiential, and obviously them experiences are key. So it'd just be really good to hear some of them sort of stories, really, or just a couple of them stories of where your leadership's been sort of not tested, but where you've had to sort of really reflect on it and think, was that how it should have gone?
Yeah, I was lucky enough that I got to go to sea with my dad and Eric Reeves for multiple years, and I picked up a lot. With regards to the leadership side of it, there is no handbook you can read. There's no documentation that they can give you, and once you digest that's it, you're good to go. This is only something that comes about after being in multiple varying situations of all different degrees. On when the, as you know yourself, Carl, when the pager goes off, you have not got a clue what you're going to. The environment, the situation, the people you're dealing with, the casualties, and to a degree, the crew that you have yourself. Now, to pick a particular incident where I was tested. We had, 10 or 12 years ago, a call out for a fishing trawler. And we were told that it was taking on water slowly, but its pumps were dealing with the water ingress to the vessel. So there was no immediate danger of it sinking, but the weather was extremely poor, to say the least. And where the boat was, she was about 12 or 14 miles out at sea. So we still had another 2 to 3 hours to get the boat in to port into safety. Once we arrived on scene, the skipper of the trawler informed us that they actually had an injured guy on board who he was getting more and more concerned about. So as we say about leadership, you learn as you go along. You look at the crew that we have, which was 7 on board, and I picked the 2 team members. They were both guys who were extremely good at first aid. Now, the most dangerous job that was there that evening was getting the 2 boats alongside of each other and transference, one guy, you know, the two guys onto the fishing boat with the correct first aid equipment, which we did do. It all went. It's as if the gods parted the seas for us for a short while. We got the boat alongside with no damage, no injury, got the guys on board, and they were making him comfortable, shall we say. 10 minutes after this happened, the skipper came on and started screaming, saying that his pumps had packed in and the water was coming in quicker than ever. Now, what I hadn't realised is that the two guys I'd put on were the two big powerhouses that I had on the boat. They were the, so we, I now had a couple of not so beefy guys on board the boat with a very heavy pump that I now needed to transfer onto the boat. So this meant bringing the boat in again to get the two guys off and transfer some other guys on to get the pump again across safely with minimal. So it's one of these things regarding the leadership thing. You need every bit of information that you can receive to digest, to take on board, and then make your decisions as you go along. Things can change. It's a dynamic theatre that you're in. Things change from second to second. And it's only something, like I said earlier, it's only something that will come with time, with going through it. The other thing is, in this game, over the last, in August, I've been a crew member for 40 years. I'll be 57 in August. And when I joined the lifeboat crew, 9 out of 10 of our call-outs were for fishing boats where they'd pinched some dodgy diesel off a site and it was full of rubbish, so the engine had conked out. They'd have a crab pot rope wrapped around the propeller and they couldn't get in. Nowadays, I would say 7 to 8 of our call-outs are for generally the younger generation who are not in a good place, who are, I don't know, struggling with life. Again, I'm great at getting a dodgy engine going. I'm great at getting a rope off a propeller. But having to sit down and chat with somebody who's in a really tough time, that's where I struggle a little bit. And we have had people come to the station and give us not advice. Well, yeah, advice. They've sort of helped us on how we go down there. So now part of the training that we build in to the leadership package is this sort of thing. I don't just need guys who are good at getting the salvage pump going. I don't just need guys who are good at putting elastoplasts and bandages on. I now need people who can actually talk to somebody who needs that. So it's another skill set that we've had to bring in to add into that leadership package. So I hope that's gone some way to answering.
Yeah, it has, Robbie. And it's one of the things that I liked about what you were talking about there is it's about, as a leader, it's not just about you passing orders out of what to do. Yeah. It's about you understanding what skill set you've got on a specific job. Where with your volunteers and it's a daytime and people can't get out of work and you've got a bare minimum crew, you might have varying experience. And actually, you've got to know them people really well to understand this job, I need you to do that. And unless that situation changes, that's what you're going to be doing.
Yeah, we have at the moment, when the pages go off, let's say the pager goes off at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning, I pull my gear on, jump in my car. While I'm driving to the boathouse, I will have a conversation with the lifeboat operations manager, or I will phone the Coast Guards direct and they will give me an insight as to what we're going to. So once we arrive at the boathouse, everybody's pages go off, by the way. So at the moment, I think we have 27 or 28 guys on pager cover. So hopefully during the night, the bulk of them will turn out in all various states and wipe and sleep out of their eyes and whatever. So hopefully in the 2 or 3 minutes it's taken me to drive to the boathouse, I can build a picture in my mind of the skill sets that I may require to do the job to the best of our ability once we're on site. Now, we do say to the guys, it's not a first come, first serve. So, you know, if you get there at 100 miles an hour, it doesn't make you say you're going to be picked. I will take what I think is the best skill set to do that particular job. All well and good, but I will also take a couple of the younger members or the newer members, because that's the only way they're going to learn. It's no good taking your stronghold all the time, you know, the guy who's been with you for years, because you need to introduce the younger guys, the newer guys. It's the only way they'll learn. It's,
Absolutely. And it's I'm guessing it's a really sort of, not necessarily a tough decision, because I'm guessing it's just ingrained in you that you know what skills you need for certain jobs. But I'm guessing sometimes it's just, you've got to make a choice, because you can only take so many people on a boat, especially if it's necky weather and everybody needs a seat and be able to strapped in. And it's just for that newer person to come along, which is vitally important for their development. You've got to leave somebody behind, and therefore you're losing a specific pair of hands that you might not have. So it's, imagine that's quite tough, eh?
Yeah, well, there's a, I try to explain to everybody that, look, if you're not happy with the decision that I've made, that, you know, when I come back, I'll be more than happy to sit down and go through it with you. When the pages do go off in a situation like that, the adrenaline's going. I understand that. And it's everybody. Again, we've spoken, and then we will speak about the volunteer ethos. One volunteer is better than 10 press men to go down. So we do have that ego of, you know, when the guys are there, they've dragged themselves out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. They've came down in horrific weather. They're wringing wet. They're cold. They're pumped up, ready to go. And I turn around and say, go and put the kettle on for when the lads get back. And that's, I do hope, and I know deep down in my heart that they do understand, but there is a reason behind it. And I hope that in time they will learn that, and they'll understand it, and they'll appreciate where I was coming from. You don't always make the right call, but you can only try with the information that you've got to make that best call.
And I think that's really important, Robbie, the fact that you're well aware of the fact that you make calls, but when you reflect on them, they might not have been the right call at the time, but you can only go with what you've got at the time. And as long as you do reflect on it, you're going to be a better person, and you're going to be a better leader for doing it. It's the people who refuse to acknowledge where things haven't quite gone to plan, or refuse to acknowledge what you could have done different, that are the sort of the dangerous people to have as leaders.
Well, one of the things that I learned a long time ago is I've been lucky enough to mix and meet multiple people within the RNLI of all different calibers, standards, whatever, and different egos. And one thing that I did learn is when we launch on a call out, I don't know all the answers. I've never put my hand up and say that I do. But what I do like to do is I will get the guys together and I'll say, look, this is my intentions. Do you think there's a better way? Can you think of another way? Or is there anything we could do to refine or make easier or quicker this thing, that this idea that I've got? Some people used to think that was a sign of weakness. Well, it isn't. For me, it's a sign of strength, because you believe in yourself enough to be able to take a little bit of criticism or encouragement or somebody. We all look at things in different ways, especially in a high stress situation where things are happening at a million miles an hour. And just to be able to step back for a second and just, you know, assess the situation and get other people's inputs as well. That's a valuable point for me, that one.
Yeah, and the other thing about that, adding on to that though, Robbie, which is really important, is that because that's how you work and that's how you function and that's how you go about your day-to-day business when you're on the boat, I've been on jobs with you where that has happened, but then because the situation's changed, you've then given a direct order of this has to happen. And because we've got that respect with you and we've got that respect around how you operate, if you suddenly turn around and say something has to happen, there's a reason why something has to happen, and therefore it's that sort of respect thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Sometimes, as the coxswain, you are the hub, you are the nucleus, and information comes in to you from all different directions. So let's say somebody who's working on the bow, I've told them to go down there with a fender and a rope, ready to go alongside, but then somebody in the wheelhouse calls up to me and says, no, Rob, they've got a fire on board, so we need to get out of the way. I then need to tell him something totally different to what I told him 10 seconds ago, And he has to understand that I'm doing it for a reason, that there's, you know, there is something going on. So yes, you do need the respect of your crew, and you do need the support of your crew. Without that, it's never going to work.
Yeah, and I think that goes on to the next point in terms of what do you think the key attributes to be a successful leader in the RNLI do you have to have? Bearing in mind, like you said, you're dealing with volunteers, and volunteers can quite easily just say, you know what, he's my pager, you can have it, I'm off. And if everybody did that, you'd have no crew to go out to sea, and you'd be there on your own.
Exactly. Sometimes I think the RNLI struggles with, again, I'm an old man now, Carl, and when you become a certain age, you can speak your mind, and they can only tell you off so many times. But I do believe that sometimes even the RNLI can lose the scope of what a volunteer is and what it's about. As I said 2 minutes ago, one good volunteer is better than 10 press men to go out and do the job. But we do have to bear in mind that the RNLI doesn't pay the mortgages. It doesn't pay the bills. These guys have a life to get on with. They have partners, they have family, they have friends. And we can, or you can so easily lose track that you haven't got these guys for 37, 40 hours a week to do the training, to do the exams, to do that. They're squeezing all this in to the few hours a week that they have spare when they're not washing the car, they're not taking the wife or the husband shopping, they're not doing, it all has to be built in. And it can be difficult, and it's a lot to ask. And in the world, the environment that we live in now, it's becoming more and more of an ask. The time, especially in my life, time is precious. It is, you know, any spare time you have has to be utilized in a good manner.
And when you go out on these jobs, obviously, like you just made reference to, when the pager goes off, you don't actually know what you're going to, and you tip up down the boathouse, potentially with your trousers on inside out, your shoes on the wrong feet, you know, looking in a bit of a disgrace because you just fell out of bed. But you might not be back for 8, 9, 10 hours, and you've got no idea of that. And once you commit to that job, once you commit to that instant to say, yeah, I'm going out on it, if you've got stuff to do the next morning, there's no guarantee you're getting back at all. And therefore, that knock-on effect is huge, isn't it?
Yes. Well, the longest call out I've ever attended was 37 hours. We went out. While we were out searching, we put into Whitby to refuel. The vessel that we were looking for actually got spotted by an RAF Nimrod that they'd bought in to help with the search. We had lifeboats from Tynemouth, Sunderland, Hartlepool, Teesmouth, Redcar, Salt Skinny Grove, Whitby, Scarborough. The full northeast coast was out searching for this fishing boat. Luckily, they were found. It was a father and son on board, and they were okay. But again, after about five or six hours, the fatigue is starting on the lads. Mm-hmm. So you then have to think about going into crew rotations, letting a couple of them go down below, either have a sleep for an hour or get a cup of cocoa, warm themselves up, and then back on deck again and let another couple go down. You have to be concerned about hypothermia for your own crew if they're on deck while you're searching. There's a lot, as well as actually progressing the search, where you're searching, the weather patterns, what's coming up in the next 12 hours. You know, is it going to deteriorate? Is it going to improve? Where will the tide have taken them? And there's a lot going on.
And it's really fascinating, isn't it? It isn't just a simple, let's get out, let's go to where we're supposed to go, job done.
We get tremendous support from the Coast Guards. In fact, it's wrong just to mention the Coast Guards, the multi-agency. We have a tremendous relationship with all the guys, from the ambulances and the paramedics to the police to the Coast Guards. The local fire brigade, we work in conjunction with them quite a lot nowadays, and we do have a good working relationship with them.
And I'm guessing that shows a sign of the time as well, isn't it? In the fact that years ago you wouldn't have really done that much work with the police, I'm guessing, because most of the stuff was offshore with boats, whereas now you're saying there's lots of stuff out there on the sea land border.
Yes, yeah, that's as you know, at Hartlepool we have a very vibrant marina. Which has a very busy light nightlife down there. And unfortunately, when young boys and girls have had too much to drink and they fell out with the partner and, oh, this is, you know, it's the end of the world and whatnot, we get asked to attend just in case. So generally, it's the police who were there first, and they involve the Coast Guards, and the Coast Guards bring us in as backup. But the guys don't mind. We know we're there for a purpose, and, you know, we're there to do a job.
Yeah, and I'd like you say that it is what it is, isn't it? Your pager goes off. You don't pick and choose what you want to go to. If your pager goes off, you go.
You go. That's right. Yeah.
So that's really interesting. I'd like to move on now to discuss the Scout incident. Now, for people who might not know, it's quite a big incident in lifeboating terms. It's quite a big issue for the Hartlepool lifeboat because it's not very often lifeboats get into strife themselves because the lifeboats are the ones going out to do the do. But everything's fallible. People are fallible. Machinery's fallible. And the weather's just nasty sometimes. Now, obviously, you were a young lad when the Scout incident happened, but the effect that'll have had on you, I'm sure, will have sort of affected how you manage your time on the boats with the history that you've got. And is that something that sort of impacts your day-to-day sort of thought process when you've got lads and lasses on the boat with you? So if you could just talk around the Scout incident and obviously then talk about, in a leadership capacity, how that's affected you both positively or maybe negatively now.
I think it was in 1993. I'll have been 27 years old, and at lunchtime, our pages went off. What we went where at the time is that the vessel was called the Frisius Fee. She was a 97,000 ton oil tanker, and she was waiting to go up the River Tees to load oil from Phillips Conoco. And the weather was really poor. We'd been out on exercise on that Sunday morning, so we had an idea how bad the weather was. We're talking waves averaging from 25 feet to 35 feet in height. We had gale force 8, 9, occasionally gusting 10. It was coming from a north-northeasterly direction, which is the worst we can get, because that means that the waves have a chance to build up all the way from Norway and then land on the beaches at Hartlepool and Redcar. Well, anyhow, this oil tanker, she'd noticed that she was dragging her anchor, and the captain had asked the chief engineer to get the engine started. They were going to pull the anchor up and move, but for some reason they couldn't get the engine going quick enough, and the vessel dragged her anchor and she went onto the rocks in front of Redcar. She was high and dry. Luckily, it didn't pierce her hull. Her hull was intact, but I think she had 26 or 27 crew on board. They'd sent Teesmouth lifeboat out to go and stand by her. Remember, we've got a 97,000 ton vessel, and they're sending a 22 ton lifeboat out to go and look after something. So if someone that weighs 97,000 tons is in trouble, it's pretty minimal what you're going to be able to do. So they sent Teesmouth lifeboat out. Now, Teesmouth lifeboat had suffered some damage. The wave had been that big, the lifeboat had rode up the wave and slid back down the wave, forcing the propellers, or one of the propellers, the wrong way. So it hydraulicked the engine. So they dropped to one engine. So they were in trouble then. So they called us out to relieve them. So that was at 12:30 on the lunchtime. So we got our gear together and we went over. Eric Reeves was the coxswain. I think there was six or seven of us on board the Scout. And we went over, and the purpose for us being there is that the helicopter, which was an RAF Sea King, was lifting the guys off the stricken oil tanker and placing them onto the beach at Redcar. Now, the wind speeds were averaging 85 to 90 miles an hour. The helicopter only does 100 miles an hour flat out. So the helicopter was pretty much flying at its full speed to stay still. So it was a high risk high risk job what they were doing, but they were managing to pick the crew up and they put them all on the beach. The captain and the first mate and the engineer stayed on board. The vessel wasn't going anywhere. It was a huge chunk of steel. It wasn't going anywhere. So anyhow, we were stood to just stand by and make sure everything was okay. Luckily for me, the weather was that bad that the helicopter pilot took the decision to land on Redcar Sea Front rather than fly back to RAF Leckenfield. So they were on the beach. At 6:30, this was the 28th of February, so at 6:30 in the evening, it was pitch black, it was snowing, it was miserable. On board the Scout, we used to have a small Tupperware box, which we would keep Snicker bars in, a Mars bar, Polo mints, Opal fruit, stuff like that. Well, we just passed the Tupperware box around, and I'd put some sweeties in my oilskin pockets. And one of the lads shouted, "Look at this." And from the glare of the lights, just one huge rogue wave came in. We estimated it was about 45 to 50 feet tall, and it was breaking. Well, the lifeboat was heading to this wave, and it roared up. But unfortunately, the wave overcame us, and it just pushed us back. So we fell back into the water. Unfortunately, I was pulled away from the boat. I wasn't clipped on. And the boat was upside down. It is designed to self-right, which it did do. But then, unfortunately, the next wave that came through hit it on its side, hit it on its beam, so the lifeboat rolled over again. By then, I was well and truly gone. I was now a couple hundred metres down tide, getting bowled along in these 30, 40 feet waves. Luckily for me, the crew got themselves together, realised that I was missing, and put a mayday out to the Coast Guard to say that one of the crew had been washed off. Again, luckily for me, the RAF Sea King guys had heard the mayday, and they took the decision to take off. Now, again, to go from standing still on a beach to 90 miles an hour in 3 inches, that's some doing. That's basically what they had to do. For them to take off, they had to go from zero to flat out to just make headway. They took the decision to go, and they started the search. I ended up in the water for just short of 35 minutes in what we call oilskin. So it wasn't a dry suit, anything like that. I had warm socks on, pair of jeans, jumper, t-shirt underneath, and I had my oilskin top on and my life jacket. While I was in the water, after about 10 minutes, hypothermia is a strange thing. You feel cold, but then you lose the sensation of feeling cold and you feel okay. So after about 10 or 15 minutes while I was in the water, I thought, why, they're taking the time coming to get me. You know, I hope they're all right. And then after another couple of minutes, I thought, I can see Redcar. I can see the lights at Redcar. When the big waves came through and I was at the top of the wave, I could see Redcar. So I thought, I'm going to swim for it. Big mistake. Because as soon as I flapped my legs, my legs had started to go stiff and I'd lost the feeling in them. One of my wellies came off, which I then had a massive influx of cold water, which dropped my body core temperature even quicker. Because I'd warmed the water up inside me suit. I did see the helicopter fly over and I thought, hey, you know, I was trying to put two and two together. But the more the hypothermia kicks in, the more relaxed you become. You do actually become a little bit sleepy. You could quite easily shut your eyes. I just have 2 minutes. But I remember them saying that's the last thing you do. You keep yourself going. When the helicopter, I thought they'd spotted me because he was flying right over me. It wasn't. It was actually the life raft off the lifeboat that he'd spotted, which was a couple hundred metres ahead of me. Anyhow, while they went to investigate the life raft, that's when they spotted me. Now, the helicopter has a device where it monitors the swell, the waves, so the helicopter can ride with the waves. The problem was the waves were coming through that big and that fast. The helicopter couldn't compensate with the waves. So the winchman actually dropped 90 feet into the water next to me on free fall. He just dropped to cut and he swam over to me, put a strop around me and gave the nod and the winched us both up out of the water. Well, as soon as I left the water, I went unconscious. Everything in my body had shut down to conserve what bit of body heat I had and everything just dropped. I was flat out. I did become conscious once I was in the helicopter. dozed off again. Then I became conscious in the ambulance on the way to hospital. And anyway, once they got me to hospital and they got me sorted out, I managed to pull myself around a little bit. But I spent several hours in hospital while they got me body temperature back up.
And that's like an amazing sort of history of that story, because their instance, thankfully, few and far between in terms of the grand scale of things.
That was the last time an all-weather lifeboat capsized.
Yeah.
That was the last time, yeah.
That shows sort of a remarkable thing about the engineering of the lifeboats for a start as well, you know. But sort of with that then, so that experience there that you've just recalled so vividly and so brilliantly, when you go out on jobs now, what impact does that have you on, because you're in charge of the guys now?
Where I come from on there is, I think I've had a taste of what can happen. So generally, when you follow the RNLI textbook, you get on the boat, you go out, you do the job, and you come back. Very rarely do they actually build in what could go wrong or what can happen or come about. So, for instance, I have been known in the summer months, may I say, I'm not a total nasty case. In the summer months, I have had the crew, I've told them to come down with a spare change of clothing, and I've said, right, we're going to get in the water now, for real. Not in a dry suit, but in your oilskin. So you're going to get wet, you're going to feel the cold, and I want you to experience what it's actually like. So if it ever does happen in the real thing, you're sort of prepared. You have an inkling of what can or what may be like. So yes, I do try to prepare them for what can happen. And it also puts me in a good position that I've been there and I've done it. I've got that T-shirt. So, you know, I've earned that right to be able to preach this little bit to you that this can happen. You know, you can be with the best team in the world, and by no fault of your own, by an act of God, something can happen that will put you out of your comfort zone and in a position where you have to fend for you and your friends to get back.
And it's really, you've just sort of raised a really valid point there around, I mean, there's the old adage in the military that you train hard, you fight easy. In the fact that, you know, you can't train for absolutely everything, but what you can think of that you train for, you want to train for in the most controlled environment you can. So then when it happens for real, it's not a shock. And and it's that whole, you know, going out in the crappy weather to exercise is really important, because the last thing you want to do is go out on a real job in crappy weather. And
That's right. We're lucky enough. I mean, the RNLI provide us with the best equipment. Second to none. We are really lucky in that. The training that they give the guys is fantastic. We have teams come from all over the world. The Australians come to Poole in Dorset to use our facilities to train. They send their trainers over to be trained. We've had the Americans come over to spend time with us and to train with us. But we can only train on the limitations that we know about or what we expect. There will always be something that is unforeseen or something that we not, like I say, we didn't know that one dirty, great, big rogue wave was going to come back and flip the boat upside down. There's things that you can't foresee. But,
and I think that's the thing with the sea. It's not like land, is it? It's not stood still.
No, it's on the go and things are changing. Constantly, all the time. In my job at work, the biggest thing that I factor in each day is the weather forecast, because things change just so, you know, what you intend to do, you can do because of the weather. You just have to build it in.
Brilliant. And moving on from that then, so you're at home now. I don't know what the weather's like up there, but if it's here, it's a pretty steady day, but it might not be. So it's like a Sunday afternoon again, same weather as what you had when the scout had its incident. Your pager goes off, you leave your dinner, and then you head down the boathouse. What's your greatest stressor or apprehension when you get the call to go to sea? And I think more importantly, has that changed over the sort of really long time you've been involved?
Good question, that, Cal. I wouldn't say I stress over it now, but again, going back to the volunteer ethos, of the boys and girls we have, the men and the women that we have on this crew, we can't dictate who's there. They have lives to live. So it's not a stressor, but I'm conscious of it, is who we're going to get when we turn up. So again, we have to make decisions wisely. Who are you going to take? What role they're going to play? The time period that we may be out for? My dad once told me, he said, before you even set foot on the boat, he said, just take a couple of seconds and have a look around. Look at who you've got. Have a look down the channel, see what the weather's like at the other end of the channel. And he said, just take 2 or 3 seconds. He said, it won't make any difference to anything. But he says, just prepare in your mind what could or may be coming up. And I that still sticks with me now, and I still do that. I always just take 2 minutes a couple of seconds just before I get on. And I just think, just take that brief moment to arm yourself with what may be needed.
Yeah, I suppose that links back to that situational awareness, doesn't it? You can only make the good decisions with the awareness that you've got. And if you don't take that time, you're never going to have that awareness to make the decisions. That's really, really, really good. So the final sort of question that I'd like to sort of pose to you, and I think this is one of the most important questions, actually, that I want to talk to you about, is that you might have sort of a lot of younger people potentially listening to this who were sort of quite early doors in their careers within the pre-hospital world or the emergency setting. But you'll also have a lot of people who've been around for a long time, and the people who've got experience can always offer that golden nugget of information that is really pertinent to them. Yeah. And has sort of seen them through good and bad. And I'm just really keen to know, from a personal point of view, if I wanted to be, following your footsteps as a coxswain of a lifeboat, if you were going to give me a piece of golden nugget information like your dad did to you, what would you give us?
Well, that one, what my dad said, that's seen me good all the way through these years. But what I think I touched on earlier on, some people do see it as a sign of weakness if you ask for help or advice from the team that you're with. That is totally wrong. It is a sign of strength. If you can actually have the gumption to say, right, am I making the right decision here? Throw it out. Let other people impact on your decision. Penultimately, the decision is yours. At some point, you have to draw the line in the sand and you have to stick to that. You're going to make that decision. But for me, the more information you can get to help you make that decision is going to, it'll help you sleep better on a night. Once the job's done and you come home, because I've done this many a time, I've got in at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, and the last thing I do is go to bed because my head's going at a million miles an hour. And I sit down on the couch, I should say with a cup of coffee, but more times out of time, I've got myself a good scotch in my hand, and I sit and I think, right, how could we, did we play this to the best of our game? Is there anything I could have done? In hindsight, how can we do it? We do now always have a debrief when we get back from an exercise or a call out. Get the gang together. Did you notice anything that we could have done better? Anything that, we should have done? How did this go? Were you feeling comfortable? How was it going? But for me, if I could offer that to anyone, feel comfortable in taking a little bit of help. No matter how high up the tree you are, take that little bit of help and that little bit of advice and go with it. And if the team who was with you are truly behind you, they won't see any wrong in that.
I sort of think that's amazing, but it also shows a lot about how comfortable you are in your own skin, in being able to sort of have that ability to say, this is what we've got to do, how are we going to do it? And I think that's where some junior leaders who were trying to sort of potentially put their mark on the world might sort of struggle.
Make a name for themselves,
So it's really, really, really good to hear what you've been talking about. So, Robbie, this is the end of the sort of questions that I sort of wanted to talk to you about. And it's been really, really good because I've known you a long, long time now. And there's some things that sort of we've discussed today that I never really knew about. And actually, now I know about them, it sort of makes a lot of sense to things. But yeah, I'd just like to say sort of thank you for all the work you've done with the RNLI for the length of time you've done it. But also, more importantly, thanks for that work you've done with the people, with the crews, because sort of without leadership like you, the lifeboat service would struggle to have the volunteers it has. So you're a sort of testament to a positive leadership style.
No, thank you for that. But hey, I'm just a small cog in the big machine, and that's how it'll keep trundling on, even if my little cog falls off, leave you alone.
Well, as long as someone's there to pick your cog up, you're all right. Brilliant, Robbie. So thanks very much for your time. It's much appreciated. I know you've been offshore for the past few weeks and you've just got home and you're knackered. So I really do appreciate you making this time for us. And I look forward to catching you again soon.
Yes, yeah, please do. You take care.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.